Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm in the University of California, Irvine, thanks to support from the Newkirk Center for Science and Society. I'm with Dr. Peter Bowler, and he's from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology in the
Francisco J. Ayala School of Biological Sciences.
We're ahead.
Here at UCI.
And he is the director of the Arboretum and the director of the Interdisciplinary Minor on Sustainability, and knows a thing or two about habitat restoration.
Yes.
And I'm loving being in his lab.
Well, thank you very, very much for coming.
Let's talk about the Arboretum.
Well, the Arboretum, well, first of all, UCI is one of the most new of the UC campuses. UC Merced is newer, but we're just about second. We were formed in 1965 and have 1,492 acres. Today, our student population is over 29,000. And since the very beginning, the UCI Arboretum has been a facility used for teaching and research by the School of Biological Sciences. The Arboretum itself is about 12 and a half acres in extent, and originally was designed to display South African elements. The first curator, or the first director, in around 1976 or so, is South African and was very interested in South African monocot species. So he amassed an internationally famous collection, planted many external exhibits, and he stepped down in 1996, and I took over. It's a very lofty position. Actually, it's unpaid, and I'm a volunteer, but I really enjoy it.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up originally in Idaho, and then went to upstate New York for my undergraduate education, Bard College, and was a graduate student here at UCI from 1970 to 1974. I did a couple of postdocs, one in Hawaii, one in Canada, and then returned in 1978 and have been working here ever since.
And did Idaho set you off on a botanical direction?
Well, I grew up in a remote area that was sort of 5 miles from a town of 90, right on the Snake River, and I worship nature, and I love freshwater biology as well, so it stimulated me. I became very interested in snails and freshwater mollusks, and it turns out that that area of the Snake River transected an ancient Blancan lake about 12 million years old, and it had the richest mollusk fauna that the planet's ever seen. And then when that was captured by the Columbia drainage and Hell's Canyon was eroded, the old lake drained, and there were 4 or 5 species that survived. And I managed to get them listed as endangered, was involved in a lot of dam controversies, and even described a new genus and species of one of them.
What got you interested in that in the first place?
Well, when I was a child, because this was so remote, my parents were sort of luminary, educated people in the area, and so all the geologists and paleontologists passing through would stay at our house, and my father would take them to various places in the desert because it's sort of trackless waste, and you'd never find it. So there was a very famous malacologist, a snail scientist, who came through that area to help with the USGS stratigraphic mapping project, using essentially fossil snails to indicate different strata. And so I was really excited about that. And right out in front of our house on the Snake River, right behind you there, is the type locality of a new species of snail that I described and named in his honor.
Wow.
So this was back in the 1950s. So I was a young kid at that time.
This is before you went to college?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So you must have had some scientific support. That was always there.
Don't misunderstand me. I described that snail species in 1990, but we found it back in the 1950s, and there were several of them. Very, very exciting.
So you always knew that this was the direction you were going in?
Well, when I first went to college, I originally didn't know what I was going to do, and so I thought I would be pre-med or something like that, but I rapidly recovered.
So what did you see yourself doing with this? Was it botany you did? What was the...
Well, yeah, basically it was sort of plant ecology. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated with my PhD, I was totally sick of the university. This was in 1974, and I said, I'll never sit through another lecture. No more seminars for me. So I returned to Idaho, and after driving potato truck for 2 or 3 months, I rapidly realized the value of higher education.
I was going to make a joke about potatoes, but apparently you can do it yourself.
Absolutely. But, so I've been essentially working mostly at UCI, but some other places as well, primarily teaching. I ran an environmental education program here at UCI from 1978 until about 1994, and I would teach a class or two each year, but in 1994 I transitioned into full-time teaching, and I teach a lot more than I'm required to teach. I enjoy teaching, and so I teach about 9 classes a year, which is much more than one is required.
And that's both within biology but also in the major sustainability minor?
Well, a lot of the minor was established in 1995, 1996, and a now retired colleague and I wrote a grant proposal to NSF, and it was funded, and that allowed us then to start the minor. And I was the co-director until my friend retired about 6 or 7 years ago, and since then I've been the director. I taught the 3 capstone classes that Dr. Jessica Pratt is now teaching from 1996 until just last year, actually this year. So I taught it for many, many years. Today I have some seminars and things like that in sustainability, and many of our classes apply to the minor. Have you had the opportunity to see the requirements for the minor? Because I'd be glad to send those to you.
I'll certainly get those and link to those. What is the... So you were developing a sustainability minor in 94, 95.
Yeah.
That's a couple of years after Rio. You're pretty quick.
Yes.
What were you called? Were you doing the same stuff before and calling it something else? Or was it something new?
There was another group, and I believe you met Julia Ekelar, called Global Peace and Conflict Studies. And I was involved with them from 1983 onward. And they went through a bunch of transitions and are now a sort of different beast than they were then. But it was similar. There were many similarities. One of the things that I really like about both of those programs is the interdisciplinarity that is emphasized, and the fact that cooperation, complementarity, and hearing what other people have to say, learning about other fields is very important.
It's really strong at UCI, isn't it?
It's very strong. And it's a funny thing. If you've never traveled and never been in another culture, you're completely sort of monoculturally based. But when you get out into the world a little bit and visit some other places, it changes you. And that's what these programs do. In fact, just behind you, this is a new kind of offshoot. This is a Costa Rica program that's focused on sustainability, where I think it's 14 or 15 UCI students go to a sustainable rural setting and live on a farm and do sustainable activities. Everything is humanure composting. It's essentially zero waste. But that's an example of one of, this is actually done through housing, but it's just an example of some of the very diverse things that are happening here at UCI. And I think one of the most exciting ones is the establishment of a formal initiative in sustainability here, which provided funding, always a problem. But that's what Abby and Travis worked through. And they have quite a few people helping that this has been able to fund.
You were in the 70s and 80s. You would have described your work probably as biological conservation. Was that the term you gave to it?
Yes, we would have, yes. And then the stuff I'm really interested in, which is habitat, essentially creation, ecological restoration. Restoration ecology in general is sort of the theoretical basis upon which the people who do the work base their efforts. It's sort of like in pharmacy, people do research that doctors then prescribe the medicine for. And I started doing that, seriously in about 1991. And the reason I did that was because there were terrible... That was a period of massive expansion locally. The city of Irvine was building out. The freeways were being built. One went right through the campus, through our ecological preserve. And so there's a lot of controversy. And I was involved in some of the controversy. But my students and I, early on, I think we published our first paper in 1994. And that was myself with 17 student co-authors.
Those are the best, aren't they?
They are. I have another one coming out with 27 student authors, so I've improved a little bit.
What is it about desert areas that the... Is it synonymous with wasteland?
Oh, no.
But in the sort of the societal perspective, it's this thing that's not been developed yet. It's...
Well, you know, America, the American mind, another topic I teach is environmental ethics. And it's sort of America was a leader in many of these arenas, although they were done in less formal ways elsewhere. But what I'm leading up to is we got to a point in our development and conquering the West. The original idea was all to be the master of nature, to... You're fighting nature. You're trying to control it and bring it into utilitarian causes. And then there came a time when the American consciousness sort of changed and people thought, well, wait a minute, maybe we've gone too far. We need to start setting land aside. We need to begin going the other way, preserving things. And I think that modern attitudes about desert are very different than they used to be. It used to be that they were viewed as wastelands. Today, people treasure them. People go out to see the wildflowers, and it has to be a little regulated so you don't love it to death. But
there's still a distinction between where we are and nature out there somewhere. And it might be wasteland or it's nature, but it's not where we are.
Yes, except that today people are incorporating nature into their lifestyles and their lives. For example, another class that I developed was one called Sustainable Landscaping. And students are very interested in having butterfly gardens. They understand that even in urban areas, if we use native species, we are the stopping points for transcontinental migrations, that the birds, the butterflies, besides resident species, there are there's a need to have the cities not be ecological deserts. And so there's a lot that's being done in that area now. I was very pleased. I had a student winter quarter who took sustainable landscaping and worked with her parents, and they completely xeriscaped a very large, wealthy lot and home. I was extremely impressed. And in fact, this same student designed a bioswale up here so that the runoff from the parking lots don't go straight into the wetland and the arboretum.
What I'm trying to get some feeling for in California, we're in California, what is the relationship between the populace at large and the environment around them? It seems to me that they've pretty well buffered themselves from it.
They
massive,
have.
Massive irrigation, let's pretend we're not living in a desert.
Yes. Well, there's massive delusion, if you want to call it that, about a lot of things. One quick point to return to your earlier comment about deserts being wasteland. Today, people do realize that these habitats have intrinsic value unrelated to people, and that's a very different kind of epiphany. This is an urban area. It's very densely populated. It is in no way sustainable in many senses. I teach field freshwater ecology and limnology and freshwater biology. I had 738 students this quarter. I just got the grades in. But most of these students have actually never been in a wetland. They've never been to a river. They've never been to a marsh. If they're lucky, they've been to an artificial pond in a local park or something. So it's exciting to awaken these feelings in the students, and it means a huge amount to them. Even though UCI is dominantly health profession oriented in its biology majors, nonetheless, they find this extremely rewarding, and they never forget it. For the midterm in my test, they have to wade waist deep in the marsh like a scavenger hunt, looking for questions in vials from bulrushes. It's tremendous. They've never had an outdoor experience like that, and they love it.
What ethic do you want them to come out with? Because you're not trying to teach them the names of the plants. That's not the measure of success, surely.
That's a easily measurable element. But
yeah.
What you want to teach them is, again, sort of the intrinsic value of these sites. The fact that, my goddess, here we are. This is an area that has 275 bird species. I never knew that. Here are 55 acres of wetland that Dr. Bowler and his colleagues designed, got funding for, and constructed for us and for wildlife. So I think some of those are the kinds of values. And then also the realism of, listen, by 2100, base level in the ocean is going to be about 6 feet deeper. And if that happens, then Bowler's right. We should knock a hole in the dike and let the estuary come in and have an upstream salt marsh. And so we talk about these things, and I'll show this to you. They love them.
What structures, ethical structures, do you give them to hang that on? Is it land ethic?
It's more or less land ethic. I think, you know, about the land ethic, you would really like my environmental ethics class. Maybe I'll send you the syllabus. But in it, we start out with the early people in the 1800s and then come all the way up through time with things like the land ethic being the 1940s version of that, but also understanding the expressions of value that our culture has adopted. For example, the Endangered Species Act. Species have their own intrinsic values unrelated to utilitarian causes, and it, as a culture, we believe that it is wrong to willfully and knowingly eliminate another life form. And that's very different than the old days of shooting the buffalo from the trains coming across America. So I have them read some land ethic. I talk with them extensively about the impacts of dams and impoundments and human impacts, pollution, things that we can cure. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about sustainability and this time, this point in time, is that we can look back and realize my gosh, we never should have built all those dams. Most of them are dead now. They filled up with mud and are no longer functional. And so there's a large movement in the federal government now among the regulators to remove dams that aren't needed. You've probably heard about it, but it's really, really exciting.
What's your favorite definition of sustainability? What's the one you want the students to go away with?
Well, I think the main thing that students need to understand is that we share the planet with other organisms, and as the human population expands in its needs and requirements, we have to do it in a way that does not further degrade, to the extent possible, the natural environment in which we live. We are cohabitors with nature and life.
And you're giving them a demonstration of what you can actually do, what you
Yes.
can actually achieve.
In my classes, I also teach restoration ecology, even in my horticulture class. But in my classes, students go out and plant shrubs and plant plants in restoration sites, and they can look at the plantings that have occurred since the early 1990s. And it's extremely rewarding, and students come back. They want to see how it's going. We have a grove of trees down here, the only oak trees that are, I guess you would say they're planted, but they're the only wild oak trees here on North Campus, and they're named after the student who pioneered their planting, the Hood Grove.
Can we make our urban systems work as distributed, fragmented natural landscapes?
You know, that's an interesting question, because we need to understand that our urban landscapes are not restoration sites, but can play a large role in softening the impact, particularly along the urban wildland interface, softening the impact of such a severe transformation in habitat types. Just as an example, here in California, we have been directed by the governor, and quite rightly so, to turn off the water on our turf. And so that's being done. Water use is being heavily regulated now, and that's very appropriate. I published a short paper in Nature, just a little comment, a couple of weeks ago with a gentleman from Brazil, actually a former student in sustainability. And in it, we made the point that removing turf is one thing, but then planting with native species can greatly increase the biodiversity of a site, particularly along the interface with wildlands. So our urban settings are sort of plopped down in these habitats, and there's a large fragmentation effect. But this can really help soften some of the differences.
I was trying to write down all the courses you teach, but there's a lot of them.
there are, yeah.
How do you keep on top of all of that?
I get up very early in the morning, but I enjoy it. I deeply enjoy teaching. And so even though I may look very mature, I'm not about to retire.
What's your favorite course?
My favorite course probably is restoration ecology. And it's so rewarding to me. Here on this campus, we built something like 19 acres of upland, 55 acres of wetland, around 3 acres of peripheral riparian habitat. We've removed over 3,100 feet of roads, and I'll show you that when we go out to the marsh. So we've really managed to expand our existing habitat in the marsh extensively through these kinds of efforts. And it's rewarding because, you know, it means a lot to students when they realize the California gnatcatcher is a federally listed threatened species. And my gosh, there are 3 pairs nesting, and I planted that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That really sparks them. It's exciting, and it is a sign of ecosystem function. So
in New Zealand, we learnt a lot from the offshore islands, the sanctuaries, and then they've moved the... They're still keeping those offshore islands because they have to, and they were the lifeboats. But now the effort has moved to the mainland, and both in terms of the urban restoration, particularly in places such as Hamilton, they're doing a lot of work on the gullies, but also trying to recognise the mixed use, that it's not a dichotomy between the productive land and the natural land. And particularly when we look at that productive land and its role as corridors in a bigger landscape. Do you see that kind of relationship here?
Well, that was one of the relationships that I was suggesting in that note to nature, that particularly along the edges, if you use native plants, you can really improve wildlife survival. We have both resident and migratory birds, butterflies, etc. There has been some regional planning. We do have large preserved areas, but unfortunately they aren't well linked. And this is something that I'm hoping some of these restoration efforts can take advantage of things that have to convert human conditions anyway and make them bridges. So one important thing to understand to me about restoration is that it really can't be done as pure restoration everywhere. Most places have been so severely damaged that you'll never get the full complement of species. And the true goal of restoration is to try to do that, to try to bring back all of the biodiversity that existed or could have existed at a site using a natural model. And so I'm talking about sort of a tiered approach. That's the pure approach. But then ameliorating the impact of humans along the line is very meaningful. And it isn't true restoration if you do something in the middle of Central Park or it's completely isolated. It can be very educational and beneficial in that regard, but it isn't connecting or expanding natural areas. And I think that's important. And certainly there have been huge efforts here in our area to do biological corridor kind of work, and we have some of that on the campus.
I was talking to somebody yesterday, the day before, two lines that resonate from the 60s. One of them is pave paradise and put up a parking lot. And the other one, which is the reverse of that, which is beneath the asphalt lies a beach, or words to that effect. And it's always been the second one has always been a challenge because it's pretty difficult to take up a parking lot and return it to paradise.
It is.
You've been fortunate to do it over a large area in itself, but a small area in terms of the percentage of California. Can we scale this?
Yes, there are efforts to scale things up. Like I said, many sites, when I say most sites can't be restored, I'm talking about maybe I'm being a little too harsh in that for people who don't know all the definitions. But like I said, to be pure restoration, you've got to have topsoil, you've got to be able to get the keystone species back. And many places like landfills and areas that have been excavated, mine tailings and so forth, you can do a lot, but it's not the real tamale. And you just have to understand that going in. But there are...
Will you be able to tell in 100 years? Can you get it to a point where you can say, we're setting it off on this path, now we can get out of the way, it'll be all right?
It would definitely be wild. It may not have been the things when the Native Americans were here, but it would be a full habitat of some kind. And there are different names for these things, enhancement, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's all worth trying. But to me, to really be meaningful, we should focus on trying to expand our natural areas and connect them. Then in urban settings, which are different from these open space areas that can be connected, if we use native plants, that's a further enhancement because the birds have to fly through and there isn't enough habitat for them to stay in. You know, here in California, regrettably, we've lost about 91% estimated of our natural wetlands. And in Southern California, 97% of our riparian floodplain wetlands. So anything we can do, I'll show you our creations out here. They aren't perfect, but they're certainly a big help. And 275 bird species appreciate them.
Wow. Wetlands and coastal habitats are where people want to live. Well, they don't want to live in wetlands, but they're nice flat land, often near the sea. They're sort of prime targets, aren't they?
Historically, they were, but fortunately, we have regulations now that make it very difficult to take those sorts of habitats, and I think people understand that.
I was talking to Kimberly Serrano, who is running the Flood Rise program.
Yeah.
And I was talking to her about the water in California, and the tendency of the initial plans was to get rid of the water, get it out to sea as fast as you can. And now they're starting to recognize that maybe that wasn't the best idea, and maybe we need to slow the water down sometimes, but still be able to get rid of it when we need to.
Mm-hmm.
Is a wetland the answer to that?
Well, there are many different kinds of constructed wetlands that are perfect for that. And of course, you're absolutely right. In fact, I gave a lecture about this yesterday, that the original inhabitants in these urban areas, including Irvine, 1968, we channelized the creek, Los Angeles much earlier. And the whole goal, of course, was to protect human habitation and areas. And today, we're changing that. Today, we're going back in Los Angeles and tearing out that concrete and putting in bends in the river and little green pockets and so forth. Water quality is at a point where people can use it for recreation now and kayak on it and do birding. Here in Irvine, San Diego Creek is largely artificial. It's mostly urban runoff. But even as such, over here on Campus Drive, our area, the uppermost end of Newport Back Bay, the estuary, is really very densely covered with riparian vegetation. And that does slow down the flood control mission. But nonetheless, there are three pairs of Leasebell's vireos that are nesting there, another highly endangered riparian bird. So we sort of have turned the circle on that. None of that other stuff will be built again. Now we're into bioswales, rain gardens, roof gardens, permeable pavers, ways to hold water on site instead of getting rid of it all at once. In terms of our parking areas, parking structures, parking lots, there are oil and grit separators that the water goes through before it gets into eventually any kind of wetland. And that removes the petroleum products and the sort of asphalt sediment stuff that comes off these lots. And we have a number of those here at UCI.
Are roof gardens, community gardens, very small-scale restorations, are they worth the effort?
Oh, I think so, definitely. Absolutely. I think that they're worth the effort on many levels. Like I said, placement is important, but they're extremely valuable in educating students. They're integral in having places for both resident and migratory wildlife to forage, live, reproduce. They're critical to linking habitats. And today, the agencies are all very aware of this and are extremely supportive. There's an American concept called mitigation. And mitigation, I don't wish to offend anyone, but it's sort of like you can sin and then tithe and be forgiven. And by that I mean you can get the legal, even though we've lost 91% of our wetlands, you can still get a developer permit for a wetlands, but you have to pay. And that payment means that you have to recreate more wetlands than you destroyed. And the reason for that is not that people don't like developers, it's that most of our mitigations fail. A big difference between mitigation and restoration is mitigation on the West Coast is largely driven by the Endangered Species Act here in the United States. On the East Coast, it's mostly the Clean Water Act. But mitigation focuses upon endangered species. And so rather than do restoration where you plant everything, you try to get the whole community back, you're required to plant many, many of the shrubs that a particular endangered bird nests in. So it's like a skeletal approach. And one other aspect of mitigation that is different from restoration is in large-scale mitigations, there's a management endowment required, and that's very critical because you're dealing with habitats that have been disturbed through planting and probably were disturbed before that. And non-native weeds are a major problem, and some non-native animals. Here in California, about 17.6 of our flora now are non-native plant species, and over 70% of those come from Mediterranean Europe because of the history of colonization, agriculture, and also the fact that those plants are Mediterranean ecosystem plants like we are here, and also they are in a sense pre-adapted, having lived around humans. They aren't specialists any longer. They can be opportunistic. If there's aerial nitrogen deposition, they take off. It kills the native plants.
Is the habitat around here naturally a fire?
Yes. This is a fire-driven chaparral and coastal sage scrub. The two Mediterranean shrublands are both very fire-oriented.
And that doesn't sit very nicely with being nestled in with urban areas.
No, it's a challenge. And
so those fires will be controlled or not happening at all?
Well, life is complex. The fire regulations allow fuel modification of like 150 feet from a structure. And that means that unless there's an endangered or threatened species present, that the habitat can be thinned, it can be eliminated. There are many different approaches, but this is a huge take in these areas along the urban wildland interface. So it's a challenge.
Do you have to burn? Are you planning to burn the upland part of the arboretum?
No, I'm not, and we couldn't do that anyway because of air quality regulations. But it's possible in the future that even though we planted and got that stuff going, that they may require it to be thinned.
So you would artificial, not burn it, but have the same effect.
Exactly. You go in and clip it. UCI has been called under construction indefinitely. and that's because we're a young campus, started in 1965, and we have expanded to a student body of around 29,000. We still have large areas to be developed, and the area above the marsh is one of them, and it'll probably be faculty housing or student housing.
All right, some questions to end with. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Well, in the last couple of years, UCI has had a history of grazing, as this whole area did. This was an agriculturally heavily used site. When I was at UCI in the early days, we used to call it UC Bovine because there were cattle everywhere. And in the 1980s, the cattle were removed, and that we have an ecological preserve on the campus. It's primarily coastal sage scrub. But the cattle had really bashed it. I mean, these cattle have been grazing there for 100 years. And so working with some agencies, I was able to get 12 and a half acres restored. And this was a big project. We went to an area on the campus that is going to be destroyed, received permission to move the native plants out, and transplanted them using crews, bulldozers, people power, got them over to the ecological preserve so that primarily it would remove all the non-natives from there and reintroduce this native known genetic stock from a local site, maybe half a mile away. And besides the California gnatcatcher, which is abundant there. There is the coastal cactus wren, and the coastal cactus wren is almost extinct. We're fortunate to have several pairs nesting, and within the first year there were pairs nesting in these cacti that we had moved, and to me that was extremely rewarding. So I'm hoping that their population recovers more now that we've got this great habitat here that we built for them, you know.
You say you're not close to retiring, but you have to retire eventually. What happens next? Is there a legacy coming behind you?
I think probably in the future things will be different, but certainly the natural reserve system will survive. And that's, you know, as I said, this campus is growing. They're not done yet. And I think that there will be efforts to try to maintain the ecological preserve in our marsh here on campus. That
it's valued to the extent that they're not going to want to build on it?
They can't, fortunately. You know, in 1970, when we purchased the university system, purchased the marsh at fair market value, it was platted out for condominiums and golf courses. And so I'm very glad we rescued it. And the way these things are done, I don't think that they can sell them. So, you know, it's sort of a guaranteed wonderful feature of the natural reserve system itself.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes, I certainly have been in the past. Not so much marching and carrying billboards as trying to provide sound scientific comment on management approaches, publishing, training. I consider teaching activism, training students to be able to understand and think critically on their own.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning, early in the morning?
Well,
other than the desperation of having a ridiculous number of courses to teach.
Well, I have a ridiculous number of everything to do, but you know, I write hundreds of letters of recommendations for students every year. I'm a popular teacher. You know, I had 748 students this past quarter. To me, every day I go to the marsh, and all the coyotes, we all know each other. You know, they see me coming, they know. And we sort of salute each other. I howl at them a little bit, and we go on. So for me personally, this has been beautifully fulfilling in my lifetime. For me to go out there and see areas, I can show you pictures that had not a plant on them. And now it's healthy coastal sage scrub with gnatcatchers living in it. I can't tell you how rewarding that is.
But I certainly believe you. What challenges do you have in the next couple of years?
Well, the big follow-up restoration that I'd like to do in the marsh, we had in 1996, Hoag Hospital, a local healthcare facility, had to do some mitigation. And at that time, we had no prospects at all of ever getting any funding. So we accepted their mitigation, and they created 6 acres of very successful wetland. In 1999, I got some big grants from the state. We were able to do about 46 acres. This past year, well, actually 2009 ending now, we have completed another mitigation that removed 3,100 linear feet of road. And that's really, that gave us a lot more acreage, because we can't get any more wetland acreage. We've got it all. It's just we need to get rid of the roads and things leading up to a point here. And that is that my ultimate plan is to make the lower part of the marsh an area that salt marsh can migrate into. Mm-hmm. Because before flood control channelization in 1968, you used to be able to take a rowboat from Newport Back Bay and row all the way up into the marsh. And the channel, flood control channel, blocked all that. So I'd like to open it, and as sea level rises and we lose that 900 acres of salt marsh, we'll be able to at least have some 50, maybe 100 acres. We'll be able to expand salt marsh for the light-footed clapper rail, now called Ridgeway's rail. I like light-footed better. But it's a highly endangered bird that has its largest United States population right here in Newport Back Bay. We saw two of them here. in our marsh, and every couple of years they come up and nest, but they're salt marsh obligates. Well, the salt marshes will be wiped out. No, they'll be wiped out. If we get 6 feet of sea level rise, almost all of the salt marshes.
Won't they migrate back a bit, like you were suggesting? Only if
migrate where?
We'll back up the.
There isn't any backup. There isn't, and that's why this is such an important idea.
Yeah.
Most places don't have them because you're developed right up to the edge. And I don't think anyone's going to suggest taking out houses to build salt marsh.
Yeah, so it is important that you're
very
ready
important.
To catch it.
Very, and, and I'm going to get that done.
Well, I hope you do.
I had a grant for it. We developed the planning. I had all the permits. And then California went broke, and they withdrew all categories of grants from habitat kinds of things. But I'm ready to go again.
Okay, so my next question, you may have just answered this. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would it be?
Well, in the marsh, it would definitely be developing the whole lower marsh as a salt marsh, having tidal inflows, studying how it's colonized, the succession that will occur. And this is a succession that has occurred not historically, but prehistorically, as the relationships between landscape and the Pacific Ocean changed. At one time, this was a salt marsh. But it would be very exciting to get that going again in the lower area.
What would be a miracle in terms of education?
I think, frankly, I think we need to have, and I'm being very candid with you because my classes, I teach classes of 400, I think lower class size and more interactive, hands-on, learning outcome kinds of approaches ultimately will be more meaningful than the large kinds of classes we end up teaching at this kind of an institution. And I understand we do have to educate people, and most of the, you know, I would say 90% of the students here in BioSci want to be doctors or something in the healthcare profession. And so they need to hear this stuff. They need to learn it. And it's a different need than the students who really want to do it.
Particularly as the links between human health and the environment become more recognized. If they're going to go off to be doctors, then they need to have got their feet wet sometime.
Yes.
So you're doing a fantastic job in that.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah.
Lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
I think that we need to be more cautious and think really about our personal, I'd almost say personal karmas, but our personal behavior. That I think, in a way, you know, when I came to California in 1970, there was so much smog right here on the UCI campus that you couldn't even see across the campus. And thanks to catalytic converters and other improvements, that's gone. And we can be little catalytic converters as well. We can make huge contributions as an individual among a larger group. And I think that's something people forget. They think, gosh, it's too much. There's no impact I can have. But you can have. And it's an impact not just for the environment or society. It's an impact for you. You can be personally empowered. You can be fulfilled. You can have huge reward as you work with others, share with your family, and this is probably the most meaningful thing of all, is your own inner light.
Thank you for that.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we're trying to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through their sustainable perspective, their sustainable lens.
Tonight's Sustainable Lens was that of the truly inspirational Dr. Peter Bowler of University of California, Irvine. After this conversation, which was recorded in June 2015, Peter and I spent more than an hour touring his wetlands. A recording of some of that, along with the pictures I took, are on sustainablelens.org. My trip to California, to UCI, was funded by the Newkirk Center for Science and Society of UCI. You should go now and follow the links on sustainablelens.org to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook to keep in touch. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.